There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Untitled Banter podcast. My name is Julian Gill, and I'm joined by Scott Telford for what may possibly be the last episode of us together, where we answer your questions, gaming, movie, food, or otherwise related. Let's just address the elephant in the room, Scott, shall we?
I can't believe you're actually doing this.
We got the mugs, baby!
We got the mugs, baby! Yeah. How long did it take? Most of this year. We thought we'd do a whole third act, is the hero dead? No, they're stronger than ever style reveal. Because yes, we finally have the mugs. They're available. There's a white version. There's a lovely What Culture Gaming blue version. There's even a What Culture Wrestling red version / What Culture main version.
Yeah.
Everything available.
I love it. The thing is that I had to kayfabe it. I had to try and like make the audience realize what they were missing out every week with the mugs not being there. But finally, we can deliver.
I want to massively shout out everybody who got in touch. We had a huge response, obviously, because it felt like we were leaving this earth. But still, huge response, massive love, and massive love to everyone who sent their questions in. And also people saying, because a few people got the joke, a few people said, oh, have the mugs finally arrived? A few other people saying, have you guys finally got a title? Which made me think of the title Banter Podcast. If we ever do a spin-off wrestling show, we'll call it the Title Banter Podcast. But yeah, overall, the UBP is only stronger than ever, and we take on your questions, your talking points, whatever you'd like us to get to across the industry. First question from DMB Does Gaming, who says, what has been your favorite console generation? Not the best, but favorite, and why?
Oh man, that's so tough to answer, because you always think like that it's going to be the first one that you played as a kid, like for me it'd be like the SNES era, but then you think about how brilliant the PlayStation 1 was because of how much fun times you had growing up with it, and then adding in things like your friends obviously coming over to play the PlayStation 2, when you felt like you had autonomy over your games because you're like a teenager, so you're choosing PS2's to buy your own games rather than like get them just like Christmas or birthdays and stuff like that. But then you've got like the brand new era of gaming now, even with PCs and the flexibility and the customization that you can do to nearly every single title. It's a genuinely hard one to pose, but you'd say the PlayStation 2 for you.
When I read that question, my gut or my soul said my PlayStation 2. I feel like that was just such a great point for the industry, where you had, you know, the AAA versions of games, the upper echelon of games were still very much affordable on the production side, so many ideas were being greenlit. And I feel like overall it was just such a burst of, you know, inventive game mechanics, genres, like things that we hadn't seen before, cinematic flair. Even things like Metal Gear Solid 2 still hold up so well today in terms of their cutscene direction, even their rendering, like they still look great. And so I've seen a lot of games kind of going back to that now, in terms of, you know, even I was playing through I am playing through Lost Judgment, and the way that Ryugaya Gakudo's studio do a lot of their cutscene direction is just lots of text, simplistic sort of animation, unless they're doing a proper cutscene. And I feel like that's almost like a lesson that we forgot from the PS2. So I feel like overall it's the PS2, seconded by maybe the 360, and then I guess like the Mega Drive or something.
Yeah, I will agree that I think that when you add in the online component as well, well. Like, like you remember where you were when Halo 2 went live for the first time. Like that was a... I cannot stress to people who are young, too young to remember this, but this was like a monumental shift in gaming. I know that online gaming was still a thing for PC around that time. It had been there for ages. But for console gamers to actually experience something that good for the first time really was groundbreaking.
Oh, man, so, Xbox Live, like, yeah, game-changing, medium-changing.
So I would say... Heart of Hearts, because of the connectivity between me and my fellow player, because of all of the good times we've had there, I'm going to go for that era of the original Xbox. So it will be about the same thing as your PlayStation 2. But if I had to choose a different one to you, because it is effectively the same era, I'd go one before for the PlayStation 1 just because of all the memories that hard-coded what gaming is into me. Like the likes of Final Fantasy 6, 7, Vagrant Story, like my love for RPGs was like... boiled in, like it was created in the forge in that point there. But
plus, I mean, that was Metal Gear Solid 1, which I will always remember as just seeing screenshots of it and not believing that I was going to be able to control it. And then like those initial trailers, and then like begging my mum to drive me to a shopping center so I could get it. Yeah, that 1997 was Final Fantasy 7, Metal Gear Solid. You also had Symphony of the Night a year later. Like that was such a time. Like that whole thing of like expanding what gaming can be. I love any generation that encapsulates that. And hopefully we're getting there with this gen, but we haven't got there just yet.
It was mad as well because the sheer amount of games that was coming out for around the PlayStation 1 at that time, you always had, like, the month was bookended by a huge blockbuster release of some point. And then in between, there was dribs and drabs of, like, crazy underrated titles. Like, I remember picking up Parasite Eve just because I was like, what is this game? Like, but I did it because I had, like, saved up some pocket money and there was just, I just wanted to go buy a game. But you look through the, like, PlayStation 1 library of how many different games there are, so many different genres, and you just got like there's a game for every occasion, and not many consoles could say that at the time, that they were constantly kicking out titles every single month.
That's what I mean about like the production, the scale side of it, the money side of it, because even from the eighth gen, like PS4 and Xbox One and where we are now, like it's hard to get that level of like, you know, tightness to a release calendar anymore. Like, and most ideas aren't being greenlit by the upper echelons of development anymore because they're too costly, it's too much of a risk, or that's not proven or whatever. And it's just, I miss when you could just make a bunch of games left, right, and center.
Do you remember the sort of exhilaration of going into your local games shop and finding that one of your favorite titles that you hadn't yet bought because it was maybe just a little bit too expensive had hit the platinum range? So it was 20 quid. 20 quid for like Final Fantasy VII, for Gran Turismo, for Crash Bandicoot 1 or 2. Like there were so many good games that ended up on that range. And I wish that they did that more now. I wish they rewarded people.
I used to do a lot more as well, was like buy a game for full price. And this is obviously the reason why a lot of brick and mortar stores just went out of business. But one of the things that you used to be able to do back in the day was buy a game for full price, keep hold of the receipt, and it was like a 2-week period that you could return it
and you just
for full price. And then I would beat a game and I would take it back with the receipt and exchange it for something else. And they were happy for you to do it because it was just a policy thing. And they were all gamers, so it was like whatever. And you could do that twice more. So I used to get three games out of one receipt and beat them all, like because you had 2 weeks to get through it. And you're only in school, so you have infinite time to play through stuff. And so like that doesn't happen anymore.
That's a bad business model. No wonder that they went out of business.
One for three. But next question from Honest NPC, who says, are EA showing hope of a comeback with Wild Hearts, Need for Speed Unbound, and the Iron Man game? Is there hope for EA? Now, I don't know if you've seen the Unbound trailer, but I was blown away by that. I thought that looked incredible. I mean, I'm a huge Automodelista fan, huge old school arcade racing fan, and for me, I know that the reaction to it's been quite divisive, but I loved it. I was like, this is such a shot on the arm for racing games and just arcade style racing and just visuals. The idea of applying like Spider versus art style to a racing game, like I'm loving that.
We've actually been missing quite a lot of this sort of pick up and play arcade racer, like you say. There's just like since the likes of Burnout truly burned out, we haven't had anything really to go from there. I mean, you get the occasional arcade racer, but it's usually an indie hit rather than
the
fully
fledged. Like Forza Horizon, and even that is still very simulation heavy.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you can list it that as that because it has veered towards more of the silly and the like over the top nature,
like stunt ramps and stuff.
I mean, I guess we did get a disastrous Fast and Furious game recently that had a max player count on the first week of I think 280 people. It was almost bad. No, don't tell me you normally.
I didn't buy it, but I almost did because I'm clamming for any arcade racing stuff.
Don't
like you said, like
buy that. Don't.
You've got to go to the
game.
Indie space. But I almost bought the Fast and the Furious game, Crossroads, it's called. Yeah, I was like, well, maybe I can play something that's arcade based. But no, like, I just, yeah, if I'm going to shout out arcade stuff, Inertial Drift is the game you want. If you're an old school arcade racer and with a little bit of innovation, it's Inertial Drift. But yeah, overall, that entire wing of driving games has just gone away.
I mean, the thing is just that, like, EA. You can't ever truly praise a publisher for the game that they put out. I know that sounds very strange considering that they have the choice at the end of the day, but they are basically just casting a net wide and they've just seemed to have just picked up interest on these there. I don't think this is ever going to repair the image of EA. It will forever be blacklisted for many gamers just as a company to avoid because of the shady practices of that, always that approach to situations of I'm going to try my best to get away with it, and when I'm called on it, that's when I'll stop. It's never it's never a true apology if you're only apologizing for being caught, and that's what EA does in spades. So
no, totally. And like, honestly, I always refer to it as like the baton of hate. Like, it's sort of like
somebody
back in the day.
Like,
at the start of the 8th gen it was Ubisoft, and then they sort of passed it to EA for a little bit with the Star Wars stuff, then it went to Warner Brothers for a bit with all the Shadow of War and the Mortal Kombat microtransactions, and now it's with Bethesda, with Blizzard, a little bit with Bethesda with all the bugs and glitches and Fallout 76 stuff, but right now it's with Blizzard and all the Overwatch 2 stuff. So there's always someone in the spotlight, and it tends to be whenever someone's being aimed at, the rest of them scuttle away and do their own little thing. In this case though, I feel like Need for Speed has needed something, because the last Need for Speed was a complete misfire, like 2018.
It was really bad. I actually went over to play with the devs, and even then when we were talking, it was just a case of like, I don't like this game, I'm really sorry. Like, I think that there's elements of this that are commendable, and I like the open world approach that you're going with, but there was just no soul to it whatsoever. So I'm really hoping that the new one has a bit more edge to it.
Well, that's what's crazy, is there's been two games since then. Like, they rebooted it. Yeah. Like, I think the one you're referring to, I think, is Need for Speed Payback, which is when they tried to do a Burnout style thing. Yeah. And then there was the reboot where they just called it Need for Speed again, and they tried to make it all live action, and there was cutscenes and actors.
Oh,
and whatever.
I do remember that was horrendous.
Yes. And then there was, whatever the hell the last one was, which I'm blanking on, but it was, again, there was another one. And then now...
That just shows you how impactful it was.
Right, yeah. And it's just like that whole thing. And so they try to do another one. But the thing is, they remastered the Hot Pursuit games, which I used to always love. And so I bought that again. And they're really solid. I think they're such a good reminder of, like, Need for Speed almost needs that adversarial thing between the racers and the cops and play that off. In this one, in the Unbound trailer, you've got... It's Criterion working on it, which is already a massive boost, because it's the Burnout guys.
Yep.
You're bringing the cops back in, but it's all Spider-Verse style, or it looks like Intergalactic, the new Netflix show, which I think looks great. Hopefully they finally just find out or remember what Need for Speed is and go down that route again, because I think it looks incredibly promising. But yeah, I did think watching the trailer that I can't believe EA is doing this. It felt like, you know, they're so safe for the most part.
Yeah, I mean, is it a risk though? I guess it is a risk once you've rebooted a franchise and it's failed and you've gone back to the well to go for it again. But
I think some people are just going to call it a cartoon style and then just that's it. They're just not going to engage with it.
Yeah, that it does risk alienating people because of the fact it doesn't seem... It's so hard to please petrol heads though, isn't it? The people who actually like love these games, because if it's a simulation, it has to be down to the nuts and bolts. It has to be accurate. If it's an arcade racer, how do you balance it so it actually feels fun and not just completely wacky and over the top? And if you are going wacky and over the top, how do you make it so that it still is entertaining to grip you through to play through to the end? It's a tough genre to go into, I reckon.
Plus that whole, you know, across the 2000s, that whole wing of Need for Speed games came out of the Fast and the Furious, the original movie, and was like very much gearing itself towards that. All the Need for Speed Underground stuff was just like ostensibly the game tie into the Fast and the Furious movies, which that whole scene has completely moved away. It's not in the cultural, you know, it's not a big touchstone anymore. The likes of Wild Hearts, I don't know if you've seen the trailer for that.
I have, I was interested because obviously there's a lot to there's a lot of memories, a lot of nostalgia that comes with that, but I didn't ever get on board when it was
thing is, like, I looked at that trailer and it was like it's old school sort of feudal Japan or Edo period Japan, but it's like Fortnite building mechanics with Monster Hunter style quest design. And I was like, I can just see a business meeting where they just kind of hold things in each hand and then just mesh their fingers and just smile as an arrow goes up on a business chart behind them.
The Venn diagrams colliding as they're just
literally
laughing.
It's just sort of put your hands together. And I'm just like, oh, like, I'm a sucker for old school Japanese stuff. I'm literally learning Japanese right now, but I do not care about you just taking bankable ideas from other things and going like, what if Ghost of Tsushima meets Fortnite meets Monster Hunter? That yeah. should sell, right? Yeah. Like, that didn't work for me.
I'm just, from your description of this, I've not seen the trailer for this one, actually. I mean, to be fair, it sounds interesting enough because you are containing a lot of elements that are very popular, but am I that emotionally invested? Clearly not. I haven't sought out the trailer for it.
I like the fact that even old school Wild Arms or Wild Arms has still got more of a place in
yeah,
your mind.
Yeah, if it was that, thing. Then I would have been on board.
Next question from Cat Sandwich, who says, best little dive bar you've been to and the best concert you've ever been to?
The best dive bar that I've ever been to would probably be, I mean, it is absolutely rubbish beyond belief, and I'm not even sure if it's still standing nowadays. Right. The Tower Inn in Torquay. It was just a place that me and my friends used to go while we were at school. Like, it was like, I won't admit to underage drinking, but if you were looking to get a pint, that's where you'd go because they'd never ID. And the atmosphere there was just, imagine your form room, but just translated over there. There was never any locals in there. It was literally just the school kids. And there was a big pool table there, grotty music. All your friends' bands would play to the group of like 5 or 10 people. And that was it. It was a great night.
That's a lush. I'm not thinking of that many. When I think of dive bars, I think of like places I'm in to get a few drinks, but it doesn't look very good.
Yeah,
or it doesn't feel good. There's not that many that I've stayed in. Like in terms of like a couple of hours in a place, I'm always like, oh, this is bad. The floor's sticky. I'm gonna leave.
Well, that's just Rise, isn't it? That's just every
exactly. Yeah,
situation.
And I'm just thinking like Newcastle places. There was a place called Basement, aptly named, which I think has finally been refurbished in Newcastle. But we used to go there every week for student times and even a few years after that. And yeah, the floor was just always sticky. But they were always like, that's just a feat. That's not a burg, it's a feature. And that's just part of the thing. I did want to use this question to shout out the Front Street Tap House. I'm just shouting that place out.
Oh,
it's
nice.
In the Northeast.
Okay.
It's near where I live. I think we've been there when you came to mind.
I think so, yeah.
And just want to shout that place out because it's a nice little bar and or a nice little drinking house. A tap house, you might say. In terms of best concerts, though, do you have anything that comes to mind for your best gig ever?
Best gig ever. I mean, I could rattle off times where I've just stood there and been like, wow, this is amazing. Mm. Like, I went to a gig with James Dowds when I saw the Twilight Sad, and they were just so incredibly powerful that it was just like, even James, who is like a music aficionado, he turned around and just said, I do not understand how they sound this good live.
Oh, cool.
I said to him, I don't either. I have no idea. It's magic, my friend. But in terms of a formative gig that I would say really put me on the track to sort of heavy metal, emo, screamo, that sort of like phase of my life, it would have been the Taste of Chaos tour that came to Cardiff that had Reggie and the Full Effect were the first band. Then it was The Used. Killswitch Engage were on there. And who else was headlining? Funeral for a Friend, I want to say, was also on that one. And there
2003,
might be
the musical.
There might have been one more band on there that I cannot remember who it was. But either way, it was a very fun gig. And it was the first time that I'd left my hometown to go see a gig. So we went to Cardiff. We drove there with my friends. We had all of the emo clothes on, you know, the tight-fitted black tops. I had the Bolt bootcut jeans that were there.
Yeah,
I mean, that was a time to be alive. I had my big fringe. Yes, I had hair like down on one side, and it was just, I think I had eyeliner on as well. I think
Do
I
you
went
any
full
photos from this period.
There may be some floating around, and I know for a fact that I had one of those classic checkerboard belts also had the matching checkerboard glove. One glove, just the one. And obviously black nails as well.
Yeah, me and my girlfriend at the time, we used to have like the checkerboard. They were like finger rings, like these sort of like material finger rings that you could wear. And that was a time. Now, my favorite gig of all time is always seeing the Big Four at Sonosphere, Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax, Slayer. Yeah. But I've mentioned them before. I think we've talked about music before where I've mentioned that. So I'm just going to do a very quick shout out to one of the sweatiest gigs I ever went to, which was seeing Bring Me the Horizon on the Sempiternal tour at the university.
So good. Sempiternal is such a good album.
I went with me and my uni friends. When they came to Newcastle, and they played at the university, but it was in the university's basement, so it was just like underneath the uni, and the stage was at the end of the room, but they weren't above us necessarily. It was just slightly, so you could see like Ollie and the rest of the guys down there.
Amazing.
But it was like me and my friends, everyone was just rammed in there because Sempiternal was such a massive turning point for that band. And everyone's loving like Shadow Moses and everything else. And Can You Feel My Heart? That gig, like we all at the end of it, our clothes had become our skin. Like we were just this sweaty mass of people, but collectively everyone bellowing every word. Bring Me is way up there. And like Bring Me have easily become one of my favorite bands. Next question from Karel Type Shaw, who says, what features do you think the next generation of consoles should absolutely have? What do you think the form factor should be? Should it be portable, better graphics, large storage? What?
Now that is a tough one because you want to say all of them. You want to say that portability plus better graphics plus better battery life. Mm. It should basically take the concept of the Switch and turn gaming into a fully portable medium, but have the power of like a like, I don't know what the graphics cards the kids are using today, like a GTX 7000,
3090.
I mean, that's like it should just be a graphics card with a screen on it. That's what it should be.
Well, that's the thing. It's like is the Switch model the future or is the Switch a one off? Like I think Nintendo will do another Switch. They'll do a Switch Pro or something, probably next May in time with the new games. But I wonder if, you know, Sony go, oh, do we revise the Vita? We have a question about the Vita further down. You know, it's like, do you think that's the future? Or do we think home console, you know, home gaming? Is that a big TV? Is that a sound system?
Well,
is that what it is?
I mean, that's what we've been told that it is. And I think that you and I both agree that streaming platforms and applications, they probably are going to be the way things go forward. Like Game Pass will basically take over the world at some point.
If they get the technology right, yeah.
If they can get the implementation and they can put it onto other consoles and, like you say, start partitioning off games and say this first party title is available on PlayStation but only if you use Game Pass, then I really think that Microsoft will be able to make a big play for the gaming market as a whole in a way that they've not been able to do so since basically creating gaming PCs in the first place. So it is a tough one to imagine what the next generation of consoles is going to be. I remember before on the podcast that I said that I thought the motion controls and VR was going to be a way forward, but now I'm starting to doubt that because even though I can see that Sony are pushing forward with their PSVR 2, it definitely doesn't seem like it's the focus of the PlayStation 5. It seems like it's always going to be the addendum to their manual that they're putting out. So I feel like maybe no company is ever going to give it the love and care that it deserves and build an entire system that is based solely around it. I just see it happening.
No, I think VR is almost destined to be a niche thing because it's just it's so hard to market because you need to actually try it to get it, to feel why it's worthwhile.
And it's cost prohibitive. It's so expensive.
It's almost like a whole other console price just to sort of like, you know, play a bunch of games that are exclusive to VR. It's not that VR stuff isn't fun. I love the VR version of Resident Evil 4, but I think that's like it's destined to always be an accessory rather than an entire platform. Yeah. But
you don't build your game library around the VR games that have come out. You always just go, cool, I can do this as well.
Yeah, it's like it has like a VR mode to it or something. I never feel that like comfortable or safe in VR. I always feel like I'm like locking the world out and I don't like it. Like it feels like it's like, you know, it's a fast track towards Ready Player One or some sort of, you know, dystopian future where we all just put our headsets on when we leave work, or that's just what we do at home and we never leave the bed and like whatever.
Yeah,
I don't want that.
And that somebody could just be messing with you as soon as you put the headset on, which likely happens when you've got friends around, like moving closer to walls, so you end up punching through them or something like that.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And I just remember when I got my PSVR, I was like, I played like Tetris Effect, one of the first things I played, which is a great game on PSVR. But I was sat on the couch, and my wife was on the other couch, and I've got the headset on, and I was like, I must just look so stupid. I'm just like sat there with this like bike helmet on, and my wife's just over there sort of reading comics or whatever, and she's just like just shaking her head, I imagine.
And because you've got like the big headphones on as well, you are completely locked into that experience. And like, it's great because, like you say, when you're playing through Resident Evil games, for example, and the horror elements really are amped up by it being in your face. But it's just that disconnection of reality where you're so not aware of your surroundings at that point that it's
like super hot is great.
Jarring.
I like the, there are some things that work really well. But yeah, in terms of like the future of consoles, I remember Yves Guillemot from Ubisoft said that he thinks this is the last generation of consoles, which is interesting. Because it's like, how far do you take it? I kind of compare it to other mediums. Like, it's not like we were looking for the next innovation in books after the printing press locked out. It's not like we need more, like, you know, film has become like better, you know, frame rates and HD and everything, better resolution. But when The Hobbit tried to do 54 frames a second rather than 30, it didn't feel right. And it was like, oh, okay, we're back to like what a film resolution is. So for me, it's about establishing that platform for, like, you know, maybe you eliminate load times altogether. You do whatever fits the creation side of it. And then maybe that's it.
You polish the gem rather than try and reinvent the wheel. I think that that's a very good shout, and I think that maybe the next generation that we see will just be, like you say, huge storage systems, faster loading times, and connectivity in with devices that is unparalleled. That's probably the best way to move forward as the industry, to take what you know but do it better.
Yeah, storage is definitely one of the big ones, because even on the PS5 or the Series X, you are filling that thing if you install like 8 games or whatever it is.
It is
if you even get that many.
It is quite funny, isn't it, how we were all just saying like, oh, well, the move to digital is going to save so much time. Like, it's instantaneous. It's going to improve the loading speed. But the amount of space that it takes up, there is actually almost a callback for disc or some sort of like physical media format, which allows you to instantaneously load. Like, you look at the Nintendo Switch and the fact that it's all fitting these games onto those tiny cartridges, and they load it almost immediately. I don't know how they've done the architecture. It works so much better, and I know that the architecture is lesser than the other main consoles on the market, but it's still mightily impressive.
Well, it makes you wonder about, like, because I've read a piece on how disc tech has come so far. Like, we don't think of discs as a thing anymore. We don't, like, I know, in terms of like, oh my god, what a CD-ROM used to be.
Yeah.
And then obviously, like, you know, game discs and everything else, and like 80% of all sales are digital. But storage on a CD has come on along massively. And I wonder, it made my mind go, like, I wonder if at some point you'll just get Sony releasing like a month's worth of games or a week's worth of games on a disc, and you pick that up instead, and then you have,
you mean
like
the old demo
solution.
Discs
a little bit, yeah, but like with full games on. And you sort of, you know, that's their way of doing like a Game of the Year version, or maybe like a publisher collection, like a Devolver collection or something,
like they did with the Orange Box back in the day with
And it's like they're all on there, and then you have like a hybrid solution to storage and loading, because you've got like a physical or a disc storage solution, and that sort of, you put that in the console or whatever it is. But at the same time, I mean, the PS5, they're moving towards a portable disc drive next year, so it's like, that's a whole thing. But yeah, I think the solution will be somewhere in the middle. But for me, storage is one of the biggest factors. Like, I hate the push towards constant graphical improvement at the expense of like physics modeling and character renders, you know, game mechanics and everything else. If it's just, how immaculate do these earlobes look? I don't care.
It means nothing unless you're in the photo mode for the game 24/7. And let's face it, there are very, very few of us that are like that. It's very funny, because I remember speaking to somebody, it was like a dev, about why so many games have photo modes. And it's the devs themselves admitted that they just like looking at the work that they've spent hundreds of hours creating. And I totally understand that. But there's only going to be a select few, and likely it's going to be comprised of those game devs or others like them that are actually going to sit there and look at every fine detail that has been programmed into those singular shots.
Yeah, that's kind of my thing. I love photo woods, and I do spend so long in them, but like, I think it's just like, it depends how much it's conducive to the overall feel of the game. Like Red Dead Redemption 2 benefits from it, even though I'm not putting the sun behind, like I said, Arthur Morgan's ears to see what color they go or whatever. Yeah. But it contributes to the feel of that game. But at the same time, I don't need every other dev wasting so much time rendering every part of that if your actual focus is on combat mechanics or something like that. Next question from Nate the Gamer, who says, UBP for life.
Thanks.
Is it more difficult to write a review about a good game or a bad game?
Infinitely harder to write a review about a game that does neither.
I was going to say the exact same thing.
Yeah, average games are the hardest thing to write about because what do you... feels like you take a deep breath, approach the platform in front of hundreds of people, and you just go...
it's a thing.
It's a thing because it feels like it's a waste of your time almost to balance out the good and the bad when the end result is so nothing that it's just like, no one's going to buy this game based on the recommendation because how can you recommend something that has equal points of detraction? So
I remember when I reviewed ages ago when we didn't have the YouTube channel, we just had the website, and I was like, you know, it was years ago, trying to get into the industry kind of thing, like trying to get What Culture's name into the industry, trying to review stuff. And we got the offer of a review of Yo-Kai Watch, which is like a Pokemon style thing. And so they sent Yo-Kai Watch over, and I was new to the whole IP. And it's not that it wasn't a solid enough game, but it just was so beat for beat exactly what it was trying to be that writing that review, I'm pretty sure it's still on the site, was just such a like weird slog where it was like, well, all the reference points I have are done better by the competition, and I can still analyze what is here, but it is so formulaic and by the numbers and quite boring. But that's what I was going to say. It's like if something's down the middle, then like, it's like the Saints Row review. That game is so by the numbers and so expected that there's just, it's remarkable how unremarkable it is for some of them. And you it's like, you know, they designed a bunch of checkboxes and then they ticked those boxes and it's just like, okay, cool. Like at least like an absolute Tire Fire gives you more to talk about. A phenomenal game or movie gives you a lot to talk about.
Well, there's a thing that they say, when I was doing my creative writing course for uni, they said that it's hard to write liked, and it's just, it is quite a challenge to write positively. But if you get yourself into the mindset of actively looking to big up games and praise them for what they do, it's easier the more you stick with it. It's so easy to tear something down in retrospect. Like if a game is bad and it's catastrophically bad, it's almost like you can hear the reviewers rubbing their hands together with glee because like you go, right, which point do I want to take apart first? There's so much... Like there's a different type of tone writing negatively about something where you can just lay into something and all the best jokes hit about it because it's comparing something to how bad something else is. You push in satire, you push in like political style, you put every single bit in there, and it works because you can just tear something to pieces. But it's harder to do that, to praise something, because you're then going from personal experiences that seem lesser as a result. So you've got to be...
So I like a mix of those things. I definitely agree with you in terms of like it can be fun to rant about a game. It can be fun to, like you said, all the things you said about being negative about something. As long as your like intent isn't like too mean-spirited. But it, like you said, it can be very fun. In terms of the good stuff, the God of War review from 2018 is one of the ones that I'm the most proud of. And that thing is almost relentless praise. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we just did we're recording this straight after doing the video on the Mario movie trailer reaction and the theory stuff. We were pretty effusive across that too, like in our praise and everything. And I think it is fun. Like I'm always, my overall maxim for reviewing stuff is like, what does it feel like they were going for and what does it feel like they nailed? And if they absolutely nailed that, what feels like that template, then I love getting super passionate about something too. This generation's been quite threadbare in that regard, but
I would say the difference between writing positively and negatively is that writing cynically is an insular experience because it's basically taking something that somebody else has done and critiquing it, where you are putting nothing on the line, but you are pointing a finger at somebody else's work. To go out there and speak positively on a game is you exposing yourself for your passions, your things that you like, why you are emotionally satisfied, and therefore it can be harder to put yourself on the line because it's a risk of, like, for example, with your Sonic Frontiers love, if you love that game, then there's going to be people who turn around and point and say that's rubbish, you're rubbish by extension, and it can be harder though to put that onto paper because it's like, do I really believe enough in this game or mechanic or element to actually put pen to paper and say that I love it? Because
that's the thing. Yeah, we've talked about this a few times before. Obviously, it comes up a lot. I'm not going to get lost on the subjectivity-objectivity thing again. Me and Josh did a whole, like, 40-minute conversation on that at one point over on the Wind-Up podcast. But, yeah, for Sonic Frontiers, like, it's not like there aren't elements that I can identify as being, like, objectively not that polished. But the Sonic love comes in. If I was formally reviewing it or professionally reviewing it, it wouldn't just be, I love Sonic, therefore it's a 10 out of 10. It would have to be more than that. That's always the test of a reviewer. How much does it feel like they've just said, I love Thing, therefore Thing is good? Like, so there's got to be more to it than that.
So there you go. You've highlighted another issue with trying to write light, in the sense that you have to back up your qualifications in a defensive structure, whereas tearing something down is much easier because you literally point at the thing and say, this is why. Whereas before, you've got to kind of like justify why you're where you're coming from, how to separate your love for the material away from the actual material itself, and then review it objectively.
Which I love. I love all that stuff. I mean, Frontiers is going to be hilarious because it comes out a day before God of War Ragnarok. I'm more excited about Frontiers than I am God of War, which is an internal clash that I have. But it's mainly just because I love the idea of an open world, super fast main character and with a bunch of snappy combat and unlocks and everything, versus what should be a PS5 game made for the PlayStation 4, which just annoys me on an internal level. But I'm curious how those things come together. Next question from Gula Lopa, who says, with the Stadia's failure and the mid-Steam Deck, do you think it's even possible for there to be a true fourth console in gaming, or is it just PlayStation, Nintendo, Xbox forever?
Well, the fact that they can't even, between the three of them, get some of their spin-offs off the ground and stay there, it just shows that the market is becoming very, very insular now. It is so hard to break in, and I think that... to be honest, I think that if you're going to try and get into it now, the fact that Google couldn't make it work with all of their tech know-how...
They were barely
trying,
though.
Yeah, I feel like they hit the ground running, but as soon as there was even the slightest bit of pushback, they were like, nah, done. We're done with this project. Move on. Which is... True. Just shows that they're maybe not the right people for the job. Amazon, again, not the right people for the job because they only want the quick turnaround, the quick buck. Like, it shows with... nearly every single action they've made, especially their new announcements on Twitch saying that they're taxing the people who are earning higher rates on Twitch even more because they realize that Twitch itself isn't as profitable for them right now. So maybe it just takes a different altruistic company to come along with billions of pounds to jump into the market, and I don't think that's going to happen anytime
soon. The
thing
that's interesting is a while ago, it was when Cliff Bleszinski was marketing that game, which name of the arena shooter he tried to put out.
Lawbreakers.
And he was talking about, it was in one of the interviews, there's a great Krobe Cat montage of all the cringe things he said and all the ways that that game failed in terms of its marketing. But he was saying that everything he's learned over the years, obviously, dude, you know, helped create Gears of War and worked on, I think he worked on Unreal Tournament as well. But either way, he was talking about, you know, most spaces in gaming, there's room for two. And he was like, you know, in fighting games at the time, it was across the 90s, it's Mortal Kombat and Street Fighter. And it became, you know, right now it's like Tekken and Mortal Kombat or whatever. And he was like, there's nearly always room for two, Call of Duty and Battlefield or whatever, Sonic and Mario. And it's like that thing where even if you bring that to the console space, even Xbox, as of last week, was saying that the biggest two entities in the industry are PlayStation and Nintendo. And they said that they will remain the biggest. So Xbox don't even really care about, you know, competing with them. And PlayStation and Nintendo do have the majority of the market share. And so it's that interesting thing of like, if you treat PlayStation and Nintendo as just, they will always be the top two. It's like, well, what can you offer alongside that? And Stadia's thing was like streaming, but then no one cared about streaming. So it's, it's kind of like, and the Steam Deck is, what if you could play the games the Switch can't play portably? But I know from having to own a Steam Deck, it's not very easy. Like, if unless you buy it off a Steam Deck, sorry, off Steam, it's not very easy to get all the emulation side of it set up and to get like a full working library. And also, the battery life is horrendous on the Steam Deck. It lasts like 3 hours.
Yeah, which is so bad. The the thing is that if you're a new developer of a video game console looking to enter the market, you have to ask yourself those questions. What's your unique selling point? What's your price point going to be? What's your target demographic or market? And how are you going to attract publishers and developers to appear on your platform through exclusivity agreements? And you are going to need a lot of money to take away the big boys from the table now, because they are already laced up with the likes of Microsoft. You've already got other people making bids for other publishers now. There are even publishers that just stand alone because of the fact that they just don't want to appear on anything less than a certain number of platforms. So
Plus, there's so much money in those names as well. I mean, Nintendo, PlayStation, Xbox, Game Pass, whatever. They're all household names. So if you're trying to bring anyone into the fold and they're already signed up with someone else, why would they go with you?
The only way that you could possibly enter it is if you approach it from how Nintendo and Sony have, where you are already in the market technically, and then you step away and redefine yourself. So for example, Capcom, they are, I would say, in recent years, outside of a few sort of stumbles with the microtransactions and approach to sort of monetization of their titles, they have been going from hit to hit to hit. They have some of the strongest IPs going in the form of Street Fighter, with Resident Evil, with even Monster Hunter. Huge hitters.
Yeah.
If they stepped away and said, none of our games are appearing on any other platform apart from the new Capcom, N-Gage 2 style thing, then they might stand a chance, because of the fact that they are saying that they're not taking part of the conversation and are exclusively going to be on this one game console. But to do that is missing out on sales in the hundreds of millions.
That would be such a play for, like, how much do you love these brands? How much do you love these franchises? Will you buy a $100 or £200, $200 system to keep playing Street Fighter or keep playing Monster Hunter?
Yeah.
And that will be the thing. I thought of, thinking of, like, case studies of consoles that have tried. Do you remember the Ouya from a few years ago?
Their
whole thing was, what if like an Android software, firmware, whatever, was the guts of a little cube USB system and anyone could code for it?
A very clever idea.
Inroad, very nice idea. But then when it came to actually saying, okay, but what games have you got on it? They didn't have anything.
It was a tech demo. We have nothing.
Yeah, exactly. And it was like the controller was terrible and the games that you got with it were terrible. But a lot of people bought into the idea of that. It also made me think of the Playdate, which finally launched this year, which is like a little indie system with a crank on the side of it. And they managed to get, like, it's kind of like a who's who of indie people managed to contribute games to that, including Lucas Pope from Papers, Please, Return of the Obra Dinn.
Mm-hmm.
But that whole thing was, you buy the system and you get a game every 2 weeks, I think it is. And they're all very uniquely controlled. And people got Doom working on that thing where the crank controls the minigun.
So
and I was
funny.
Like, that's... But immediately I was like, that's more fun than any of the little games that I get with the thing.
Yeah.
It's like, it's kind of just like, what can you offer if you just take it as assumed that, you know, the Titans are going to remain the Titans? All we could do is fight amongst their feet at this stage. It's like Attack on Titan kind of thing. Next question from Jack Asbury, who says, do you think CD Projekt Red can actually deliver on the forward plan that they released this week? Did you see this madness?
Yeah, there's a lot of new titles and expansions that they've announced. And I actually do think that they will eventually complete all of that. I don't know if they're going to hit the time frame that they've been talking about, because
they reckon that trilogy's coming in the 6 year period. So it's like one game every 2 years.
Oh, yeah, and that seems like it's quite rushed considering the size and scope of the Witcher series in general. And then you've got another team that's working on the Cyberpunk expansions and possibly a standalone
Cyberpunk sequel, whatever Orion is.
So I feel like there's too much going on. They probably announced it way too soon. They probably should have just stuck to one franchise. Like, Cyberpunk is hot right now. It is.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's the hottest it's ever been, and it works a treat now. So they should have doubled down and just said, hey, listen, there's more coming, and we are hitting the road running with this. But don't worry, Witcher's still being developed. That's all they should have said. But just...
Well, I think the... Oh, sorry.
That's it. They should have just done that.
I think the reason that they did all that stuff was to counterbalance the fact that Marcin Nowinski's stepping down as CEO.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like that, because that announcement was just buried by all the people going like, oh my God, the new Cyberpunk, oh my God, the next Witcher. Because I just thought it was like a shareholder price thing, where it was like, if they just said Nowinski's stepping away, I mean, he's stepping into a different role, but he's not going to be in the a part of CDPR, then their stock price would have dropped. So it was like they immediately got out there and said, don't worry guys, there's seven games coming.
And this is what we spoke about before with the hype doing all of the teasers and trailers for just the investors. It's literally just to keep their pockets lined with investor money, and it makes sense from a business standpoint, but that information hitting the public is now I feel I'm overwhelmed with CD Projekt Red titles. I feel like my hype for them hasn't actually gone up in the slightest. It's turned to worry immediately, because I think there's too many plates that are spinning.
I think as well, like, the amount of time that it'll take to get all this stuff turned around, I think it's a weird move for a company to be like, this is what we're doing for the next 20 years. And I'm like,
it's nuts.
Cool.
And how many?
I'll be 50 years old.
How many times has roadmaps actually ever worked out for a company? Mm. We've seen like the likes of BioWare with Mass Effect. They announced all of the stuff that was coming out, or Anthem. I can't remember which one it was, and then it just completely got derailed a couple of months after the fact. So
both, actually.
So this, to me, I do think that they will deliver each of these titles. I just do not think that they will hit the time frames. Or if they do, I worry. I mean, can they risk another Cyberpunk launch day? They
I mean, their stock price went down 75%. So it's
that
like
is insane.
I feel like that's why Iwinski's stepping away, because it's like he's weathered the storm. He was the dude doing the apology video. Even though, if according to a lot of the reports, it was Adam Badowski whose choice it was to gut the game and change everything and remix the story and everything. But I feel like Iwinski was like, I'm going to keep, you know, captaining the ship. I'll get us through these rough waters. And then when things calm, he's like, the first chance I get, I'm gone. And so as soon as the Cyberpunk stuff was like, Edgerunners took off, the game's stable, he's like, I'm gone. Like, you guys can take care of this. I'm moving away to save myself. Overall, though, to wrap this up, massive thank you to everybody for sending in their various questions. Everything's okay. We ain't going nowhere, but you can grab your UBP mugs. Actually, we didn't even read out the URL. Let me.
What, you're going to go for the full www/?
I'm going to tell the thing is, now it is over at whatculture-wrestling.creator-spring.com, and then you can just go on the mugs, the drinkables, I think is the category, and grab yourself a mug.
Too long of a listing, that is. Too long.
I didn't realize it was on the, it's like a spin-off of like the What Culture Wrestling page. I was looking for it on our merch page, but someday we'll unify those things. But yes, massive thank you to everybody for sending in their various questions and talking points. This has been the UBP, the UBP,
the UBP,
the UBP, now and forever. I've been Scott Tilford, joined by Jules Gill.
Thank you very much for having me. And remember, you can check back next Thursday to pop your suggestions and your questions in for the next episode, because like Scott said, we are not going anywhere. We've got our mugs. We're here to stay, baby.
Yes, we'll catch you next week.
Bye.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And UnitedHealthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.